So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're talking home renovation and repair today with Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry of Madison, and John Viner, John, Senior Project Manager and Residential Building Performance Expert at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. So we can talk about energy, we can talk about fixing your home up, and certainly glad to have your calls. Give us a jingle at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Chad, good to have you back again.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
And John, great to see you again as well.
Yeah, thanks, Larry.
Do you guys know anything about these new EPA regulations that are coming in to protect families from lead?
Absolutely. It's an important step. I'll give a little bit of a historical background on it. Back in 2001, a law was passed in the U.S. Congress to enact standards for dealing with lead in renovations. And at that time, there was information presented showing that there are two income groups that were adversely affected primarily by lead dust, lead poisoning. Those were the poor and the wealthy. And the reason that many lower class citizens, children get exposed by lead is rundown buildings. The reason that many wealthier children get affected is by ongoing and constant renovation.
Oh.
And often in older homes, nicer homes, and those nicer older homes tended to have lead paint in them because the lead paint was the higher quality paint. So anyway, that's why we have finally created some rules. And again, this law was passed 9 years ago. It took until 2006 for the EPA to actually present its rules based on the legislation, and now it has taken 4 years for various states to draft their exact rules for how we're to follow it. The best way that I can explain it to potential customers and to contractors that are going to be affected by it is that we've essentially decided that we're going to set some standards to make it safer to renovate homes. To protect all of the occupants as well as the people who work in it. You know, for 40 years, we've had OSHA, and we've had basic mm-hmm. rules that tell us how to safely work out in the world.
Sure.
How to put ladders up against a building and things like that. And we all live under those regulations and are able to still do business. And it's good to have some standards. And basically, potential lead poisoning is something that we really haven't dealt with until this legislation. So what does it mean? It means that any contractor who works on a home and is going to disturb more than 6 square feet of interior space or 20 square feet of exterior space needs to be lead certified. And they're going to need to do some additional record keeping, and they're going to need to utilize some work practices, primarily more thorough isolating of the work surface and containment of the debris so that it does not contaminate the home or the yard or the occupants. Lead dust, of course, once it's airborne, is a potential threat to health.
Sure.
And, you know, on the federal level, there is an opt-out provision at the time. It's likely that that opt-out, which means that a homeowner or a building owner could say that they don't, you know, that they release the contractor of liability. But that opt-out does not exist in the state of Wisconsin. And I think, frankly, that the days of the opt-out are probably numbered on the federal level as well, because it's widely agreed that there could be some abuse there. And, you know, how to protect, say, a landlord from opting out and then, you know, endangering the tenants in a building, for example. So at the moment, it's a moot point in Wisconsin because everyone has to comply. The only way you can really get out of it is if you're the building that you're working on was built after 1978, whereby it's assumed that it is a lead-free building. It's not necessarily the case, but that's the way the law is written. And then the other thing that you could do is you could have the building professionally tested by a lead inspector. And if you certify that there is no lead in the building, then you don't have to follow the practice either. But if you do find there's lead, then you've opened up a whole nother can of worms, and it's not good enough simply to then have lead-safe practice. You're probably going to have to hire a lead abatement contractor to come in and remove all of the lead in the building. So it's a little complicated. Uh-huh. It's going to take a while to work through the details, but April 22nd is the date that this takes effect. That is Earth Day. So everyone's gearing up right now, getting certified, and educating homeowners. It will definitely add some expense to remodeling.
All right. Good explanation. Thank you for that. Diane in Madison has a question for you guys, so I'm going to turn to her now. Diane, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. Maybe 2 years ago, I had my whole roof replaced. It was a tear down and complete replacement. And I've noticed since, just a few months after it was done, as the weather warmed up again, that there seems to be some rippling across the front of the roof. Sometimes it's more noticeable than others, and I just attributed that to swelling or contracting of the shingles. So I'm wondering if this is something that need to be concerned about. I haven't been successful in getting the roofer to come and deal with it, even though I've tried repeatedly.
Okay. Well, it's not unusual to see a little bit of rippling often after a roof is installed, and that has to do with the underlayment often having a little bit of rippling in it, and then over time that settles out. To see rippling after a couple of years, it's hard to say whether you're saying that it was flat and it has started to become rippled?
It's something that I noticed, you know, within the first few months after it was installed.
Okay. It could be a circumstance of just the, you know, the shingles were not, and the underlayment was not laid out properly, not quite given enough space. And so, typically one course of, or one shingle, which will be about 3 feet wide, will have four or five nails in it. And so if there is, you know, that should lay flat on the roof, but if the nails create a little bit of a kink in it, those imperfections, if you will take a while to work out. Hopefully it doesn't diminish the ability of the roof to keep water out. Sometimes some minor rippling will, over time, just settle out.
Okay.
But I would continue to be persistent in trying to get the roofer to come and take a look at it. I would imagine that would be something that would be under the warranty. It should be, particularly if you noted it within the first year.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Casey in Whitewater, we're on to you. Hi, Casey.
Good morning. I'm replacing a furnace and an air conditioner, and the contractor has recommended instead of the air conditioner that I install an air source heat pump. I'm just wondering how efficient or effective those are in our climate.
Okay. John, you want to?
Yeah, the air source heat pump has been becoming more and more popular. Certainly the efficiency is good. Usually we get some high efficiencies out of the air source heat pump down to a certain temperature. As it gets really cold outside, we still have that secondary or the backup gas furnace to help out. I think that it certainly can be a good purchase. I would look at some of the incentives that may be available to you for that air source heat pump. I think it's a matter of personal preference. One thing to keep it in mind with an air source heat pump is that if you're used to a hot air blowing out of the registers with a normal forced air furnace, the temperature discharging from those registers will be a little bit cooler. But so that might be a little bit of a disadvantage on the air source heat pump, though using that electric source effectively for kind of the shoulder seasons, if you will, not through the dead of winter, you're going to be using a little bit more gas, but that air source heat pump can certainly be effective on the shoulder seasons.
Okay.
Sounds like a good idea then.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Amy in Schulzburg next. Amy, hello.
Well, hello. Good to speak with you.
Thanks for calling.
I live in a town that has very hard water, lots of calcium minerals in the water. And we are in the process of moving from a traditional hot water tank water heater to a tankless water heater. And I've heard both sides of the coin, whether or not, how necessary is it that we put in a water softener for that?
Yeah, it is absolutely necessary to put in a water softener with that tankless water heater, because that's a device which should give you 20 to 30 years of good, dependable operation, but the hard water is the one thing that can interfere with that. And it's really important, of course, not just to have the water softener, but to maintain it, keeping the salt pellets in there.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Sort of on a related question here, we had an email from Dee. House is 24 years old, and so is the gas water heater. It doesn't show signs of failure, but wondering if she should just go ahead, or they should just go ahead and replace it now, or wait until it shows signs of failing.
Being 20 years old, I think certainly you can feel comfortable moving on to a new water heater. I think that they rate the efficiency of the water heaters by the energy factor, which maybe an old 20-year-old water heater maybe have an energy factor of, say, 0.52 or 0.55. And that might be, you could look at that as an efficiency rating, 50-55% if we're doing good on that 20-year. And a power-vented water heater probably would be the strategy to go with a tankless, a power-vented, or a condensing unit where we can really up those efficiencies to 80 and 90% on that condensing unit, or up to, with the standard power vent water heater, we would want to go to 0.64 energy factor or greater. In part that there are incentives through the state's Focus on Energy program for a power vented water heater having that energy factor of 0.64 or greater, though it does hinge on you bringing in that home performance consultant to do a little bit more thorough analysis on the building. He's going to do some safety testing on the water heater and possibly qualify you for $250 towards that new water heater.
All right, let's go to Lynette in Richfield, Wisconsin. Hi, Lynette.
Good morning. I have an outdoor light fixture, one of many, but just one of them seems to go through light bulbs at an excessive rate. Sometimes they'll last for a couple of months, and other times just for a couple of weeks. Is there a short, perhaps, somewhere, or am I just buying bad light bulbs, or what?
Well, chances are when you see a consistent failure in a short period of time, there is something causing that. And the two most likely reasons that would happen that I'm aware of, one would be excessive rattling or vibration that could be happening at that fixture just because of the its particular placement on the house, and it might be connected to an area where I don't know if if there's someone in the house, if you have kids or someone that likes to jump around in that vicinity, for example. I know
it's right next to the service door, which we're in and out of with the dogs continuously, and that door slams.
Okay, so that's an ex.
Oh, yes, the rattling.
That could be it. That it could be the door slamming is enough. I mean, that's a pretty good jolt of vibration every time that door slams, and that could be leading the filament to fail prematurely. And then the other thing could be some sort of problem with the voltage going through it, and that would require an electrician to test that circuit. You know, that is perhaps a little bit easier to diagnose, though, you know, I'm sure standing there and slamming the door, we'd be able to see just how dramatic that is. And some things might be able to be done to help to cushion or buffer the fixture to reduce that the failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking home renovation and repair issues today with Chad Spate of Chad's Carpentry in Madison and John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Patrick emails us from Madison, wonders if you could talk about finding a designer builder in lieu of an architect. I'd like to add a small addition to a bungalow house. Want to keep the cost down. I also wonder if it could be placed on pilings rather than a poured foundation for this addition. What do you think, Chad?
Well, certainly, you know, the advantage to working with a design build firm as opposed to just an architect is that you're always considering the price of the project in conjunction with the design, though it's still a little bit of a chicken and egg even when you're working with a design build, because you've got to design something before you price it. And then once you price it, you may alter the design. So the nice thing about working within one company on that is that they can go back and forth working with you, you know, and you're not having to play the referee between independent entities of your builder and your architect. As to whether or not you might build an addition on a up on pier footings, yeah, that, you know, it's something that you can consider, but the important thing to keep in mind is that in our climate, and frankly in any climate, you want to have a good thermal envelope, and we live in a heating season here that's pretty substantial, so you're going to be needing to heat that addition. And it, you can successfully build a home that is insulated on all sides and that is not in the ground. Whether you're in the ground or floating above the ground, you have to insulate yourself on the entire envelope. So, you know, you are going to have other issues that you're going to have to consider if you have that floor up out of the ground on these piers. You're going to have to seal it up, insulate it properly, and you're going to be having to worry about pests and other things, rodents kind of breaking through that. Of course, that's a concern that we have anyway with any home. John, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, I think you wouldn't expect to put it up on piers and, say, use fiberglass insulation in that floor system. Right. So you'd really want to be committed to a little bit higher quality insulation air sealing package and commit to hiring a quality contractor that's going to use likely a spray foam product to keep that floor nice and warm and get the performance out of it. So that would be one consideration for sources or for a design build firm. I would look at the NARI Association. You know, and just take a look at who's in their directory and do your research there.
One other thing that I would add, building on this, is that, you know, a lot of times homeowners, when you mentioned cost, and of course any homeowner is wise to be thoughtful about the cost, but it's important to remember that you're going to have to pay to heat and cool your home. And to make a well-built home or to improve an existing home in a way that reduces the energy load, that's going to require an investment with a knowledgeable contractor. And, you know, the research will show that spending that extra money to make your house more energy efficient is often a very good investment. You're likely to be able to offset the added mortgage expense with the reduced energy cost There's no hard and fast rule on that. It all comes down to quality workmanship and a good plan. But it's definitely a wise investment that many people don't make.
There you have it. We had someone email in and regarding the woman with the erratic light bulb. Person said she might consider a roughneck high vibration bulb such as those that are used for garage door openers. That's probably a good idea too.
Excellent advice.
Yeah, good advice. Thanks for that email. Kevin in Tomahawk, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning. About 7 years ago, we had an asphalt driveway put in, and over the last 2 years, we've had blowouts of like 3x3 areas or 5x5. We've had three of them. Now we just had our fourth one where they had to keep cutting back the asphalt to find 2-inch thickness. And first of all, are we would be acceptable to say that we want the driveway tore out to the contractor? And is the contractor still liable after 7 years for the quality because he didn't meet the contract requirements of a 2-inch compacted surface?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, we don't have very good consumer protection laws in the state of Wisconsin. You know, really it comes down to what the contract says with respect to workmanship and warranty. And if, in fact, the contractor did put in what he agreed to put in, then, you know, sometimes it could be that they didn't properly prepare the surface, but then other times it could just be that the particular weather that we've had over these last 7 years, and I'm recalling some pretty harsh winters and some pretty wet springs and summers, that those circumstances have unfortunately conspired with the particular landscape that you have to degrade this. Now, you know, having said that you've had these multiple failures, that would indicate that maybe some things weren't done quite right. It could be that the mix that was used had some imperfections in it.
Thickness wasn't there. It was supposed to be 2 inches, and every time it was a half inch or 3/4 inch thick of asphalt versus 2 inches.
Oh, I misunderstood you. Well, that's okay. Definitely, yeah, I would... Yeah, I think that if that's the case, then, you know, you have grounds for demanding that that things be done as they were expected.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Beth in Hammond wonders what kind of rock – she has a driveway wondering what kind of rock she should add to it. Says, I need to add rock to my driveway, and was wondering what kind of rock would I add. So I assume she's got some sort of gravel driveway. We probably need more information on that one.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, typically it's a crushed stone, but I'm not, you know, I just don't
we need some more
much
information
expertise
on that.
There.
All right, let's go to Don in Boaz. Don, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question concerns the 4x6 timber upright supports for our porch, which was built for us about 10 years ago. These things are developing long vertical cracks, and some of those cracks are getting as much as a half an inch wide, and I'm very concerned about that. Every one of them is affected this way. Is there anything can be done about that?
Well, that is the nature of wood, unfortunately. I mean, the best thing that you can do, what sort of stain or preservative has been applied to these timbers?
It was a semi-transparent stain.
And was it just done when it was built, or has it been applied in subsequent years?
No, it is still the original semi-transparent stain.
Okay. Well, so it's time to refinish the porch, and you might consider talking to some painting contractors that can apply pressure spray sealant that will help penetrate that timber in the areas where it is cracked, because the timber will exhibit those sorts of stresses, and that is what will happen. And the longer it goes untreated, the more severe those symptoms will be because it will take on more moisture. When you're painting or staining an exterior wood surface, you're primarily protecting it from the damage caused by moisture. And so with a board like that, with a finish that was applied 10 years ago, it's going to continue to show more of those signs of water damage. But that doesn't mean that you need to replace them necessarily. They just need to be properly resealed.
Okay.
Do you think I might be able to get some silicone-type caulk or something and go in there with a caulking gun and press it in there real well and have a finished job?
Well, it is possible that some things could be done, but there are issues of aesthetics, and then you also have to be concerned about trapping water in a timber and leading to other problems. So those sorts of approaches need to be undertaken with great care.
Yeah, yeah. If you get water behind that, then you start getting rot from inside, I assume. And
correct.
That could be a problem.
It would be very important, for example, that at the base, that you not seal it up completely at the base so that if there is water that does get past the sealant, it is able to drain out at the bottom.
Yeah. There you go, Don. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Sandra in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I'm calling because I live in an older, poor neighborhood, and previous owners kind of did whatever it took to make it work. One of the things that they did was the vent pipe comes over like the kitchen drain, and it comes up in a second floor bedroom, goes along the wall, and then like out through the ceiling. Is there something I can do to relocate that without ripping out the walls? Can I put that on the outside of the house?
That's an excellent question. This is a plumbing vent that we're talking about. Is that correct?
Yeah, if I can open up the kitchen, the cabinets under the sink, mm-hmm. and it comes right over the drain.
Okay.
So I assume that's the vent pipe.
Right. Yeah. The building codes, as far as I understand them, do not allow for a plumbing vent to be exposed on the exterior of the house, but for a vent which is just serving a sink, mm-hmm. Or say a tub or shower, but primarily for sinks. Those vents can be done mechanically with what's called a StertiVent, which is a vent device that is installed under the sink, mm-hmm. and it will allow some air to come into the plumbing system if it is needed to maintain proper ventilation of that plumbing pipe under the sink. And so then you're able to discontinue that path out the roof. Now, if there's a toilet that is being vented by that vent, the rules are different. But, that's something that a professional plumber could look at and give you some options. The other option, of course, is to open up the walls and allow that vent to be installed into the walls so that it is not visible in the room. Okay. And then, of course, something can be built around it as well as another way to disguise the unsightly vent pipe.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have the StertiVent, I can just get rid of the vent pipe that's coming in the second floor.
That's correct. But and you will need to, of course, patch the roof. You don't want to leave the old vent pipe sticking out because the old plumbing vents are wet vents typically, and the rainwater falls in and it ends up in the drain, which is fine. But if you cap off an old vent, it's important to cap it off all the way to the roof.
And could you just spell that, please?
StertiVent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I believe it's spelled StertiVent.
Great. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Eric in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in regards to water. At my house, the drinking water is just terrible. It has a very strong taste of iron. And I was wondering what I should do to get it so that the water isn't so iron tasting and it's more bearable to drink. Is there anything that I could buy or install that?
I assume you have a well of your own, or is it municipal?
It's a well.
Okay.
Certainly there are whole house filters and there are at point of use filters. I believe a carbon filter would be able to take that iron out. There are other more expensive options. Reverse osmosis is another way that would take that out, though I find that that uses quite a bit of water unto itself to, I think it's 5 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of clean water through the reverse osmosis. So you do get very clean water, though it's resource heavy. That carbon filter, the particulate filters right at the point of use where you're drinking probably is a good way to go. Chad, do you have other options?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that, you know, you can have a multiple filter system installed under the sink or down in the basement, coming up to a little, you know, fresh drinking water tap at a kitchen sink or at a bathroom sink. And that's a great way to, you know, have a convenient way to have better tasting water on demand. But then you do have to, you know, change the filters.
Because we tried a reverse osmosis system, and it didn't really seem to work any better than what we thought it would do. Because it's getting to the point where, you know, you go to shower and it just smells, you know, of iron, and it's just getting to the point where we want to try and get it fixed. And
yeah,
I heard that there is a system that you can get that you can normally rent, and like they'll come and hook it up. Do you know like what that system might be called? If I go shopping for it, is there some kind of system in particular that I should look for, or?
No, I don't have an answer for that. Sorry, I'm not familiar with the water.
We just did a show the other day on water, and one thing that you might do, the DNR in your the Milwaukee office down there has a water quality person, and they might have some other options for you as well. We talked about this. Stephen Ellis was on the show from the Department of Natural Resources, but he's from this part of the state, in the Dane County part of the state, but there's a regional office in Milwaukee, and I'd check with them too because there may be some other. Have you had your water checked by, for example?
We have not. No.
You should have your water sampled to begin with because there may be other things going on with that well as well, yeah. so to speak. And I know just from that show that they're recommending with a well, you should be having your well water sampled about once a year. And with that, with those kinds of issues, you'd get a pretty good report on what you've got in your water, and that would also help you maybe in deciding what you need to do from there. And a water sample it's not difficult to do. You can take it. It goes to the state hygiene lab in Madison, and they'll come back with some recommendations and tell you what's in your water. And you really, if you're getting that kind of issue, you really ought to have it checked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And as I said, too, your DNR regional office has a water quality person who would be able to visit with you some more. But I'm sure that we just did that show, and the guy said people do not test their water enough. They should. If you have a well, should do about once a year. Kevin in Platteville, on to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Say, I've got a soil venting question, soil pipe venting. I got one of those old two-story houses with a 45-degree hip roof with a little flat top on it. And I've got like a 2-inch going up to the very top, and then it turns into 4 inches when it goes out. I don't know why. Then I also have 2 4-inch vents near the edge of the roof, and those are 4 inches all the way down to the basement. Can I combine those to, like, turn them into, like, 1 2-inch vent, put them all together and run it out the top?
Well, you'd have to talk to a plumber about that to look at it, but I suspect that the 4-inch soil stacks that are coming directly off of toilet runs are going to remain that size. I don't I rely on our plumbers to know this particular detail, but my recollection is it can't be any less than a 3-inch when it comes out of the roof. And there was a time when just standard practice, even the larger pipe would be increased to a 4-inch. And I think the thinking back then was to have a big enough pipe that would collect a little bit of water and kind of flush the system out. But that's purely speculation. frankly, I think there's a danger to reducing that pipe coming down, because if something were to lodge in it, then you would no longer have a functioning vent. So, but I would not recommend fooling around with that without discussing it with a licensed plumber.
Okay.
All right.
Or a building inspector, of course.
Sure. Mike in West Dallas, it's your turn now. Hi, Mike.
Cody, what I'd like to know is two things real quick. The venting size and type for a exhaust over a stove going through the ceiling and out the wall. And then the debate over vapor barriers. I've been reading in Building Science on their website, and they're saying now that you don't need a vapor barrier in a house that kind of breathes. Matter of fact, they kind of speak against it. So do you know what the latest word on it is?
Yeah, we can certainly, Chad and I, I'm sure we have some opinions about the difference in applications of vapor barriers versus what we might call an air barrier or air retarder. Back to the first question, though, the vent size over a stove. The exact specifications probably relate back to burner capacity and the burner capacity of the oven and the stove. But generally, we're seeing we want to measure a good 100 CFM, maybe to a good 150 CFM is pretty standard. The type is generally just more related to placement. We want it over that stove so it grabs that moisture and or natural gas fuel if we have a natural gas or propane stove. So really certainly we want it within 10 feet if we can of that stove. Certainly we want it right over the stove itself for maximum performance. Whether we need a vapor barrier or not in the home, what's key is that we have an airtight barrier. We make the house tight, then we are able to reduce the moisture transport that's causing most of the types of problems in building degradation that takes place. It's all about moisture and controlling moisture flow. A vapor barrier isn't always the best way because it can be installed properly, and then we have holes and seams and staples and nails and screws and electrical boxes and light switches, fixtures, all within that vapor barrier. So then it becomes certainly less effective. But what's key is having the sheetrock surface itself being possibly caulked at the base on the bottom plate of the wall, caulked at the top plate, caulked around the outlets, making something that's a system within that wall that we stop all or 99% of that air movement, which is carrying the moisture. So we don't need a vapor barrier to create a durable house that's going to be energy efficient and healthy and long-lasting, all those qualities that we really want. It's not necessary to have a vapor barrier, though it has been one avenue to control moisture that's really been highlighted by the building codes. But vapor movement is one way, vapor diffusion of that molecule moving through the wall assembly, creating problems. But turns out it ends up being a much smaller concern than air movement and just having holes within that assembly.
Yeah, and I would add to that because John's absolutely right, I want to say that. We don't disagree on this, and the science actually doesn't really disagree. If we could do one thing well in homes, and that would be air sealing them and filling up all those cavities with a high-performance insulation material after having air-sealed the various holes that are in the structure, then we would be far less concerned about vapor barriers and that dreaded word ventilation of the structure, because there's a lot of confusion. For example, in dealing with ice dams, if you properly air seal and insulate a home and then have created that good shell, you are going to deal with vapor problems and you're going to deal with things like ice dams, whether or not the roof is well ventilated. The reason we put up vapor barriers and we put ventilation in the roof to deal with problems is often because we've thrown in the towel on properly air sealing and insulating our homes. If homeowners put their efforts into, and builders and remodelers really put their efforts into good air sealing, a lot of these problems would not be coming back to vex us.
Mm-hmm. But certainly we don't do that air sealing without interior ventilation, right?
Oh, yes.
We got to go back to the interior space of venting the stove appropriately. And then really it takes a step that not all builders have taken on, and that's actually testing that we did a good job related to the air barrier. So if we're not testing and we're building to the code standards, which are the minimum standards to build to, we don't always know what we got and how well it's functioning.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spade and John Viner, our guests here as we talk home renovation and repair on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls as we visit with Chad Spade and John Viner here on the Ideas Network. Nathaniel and Menominee, you are next. Hi.
Hey there. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask you, basically, out where I'm staying right now, we have, we've got, basically the water out there is really, really, really calcium filled, and it basically we can't drink it because it tastes pretty bad. So what I was wondering is, do you guys know of any way that is able to, you know, filter that or do it in a way that it's not on the outside? We had gotten a Brita filter earlier, but living with 41 cats and 5 teenage boys, it makes it a little hard to keep that alive.
Well, I think a water softener takes out some of the calcium and magnesium is really what a water softener is designed to do, so that mm-hmm. can certainly take some of that out. There are some questions related to drinking the soft water and the sodium that it replaces it with, right? Essentially, we pull out those hard minerals and replace it with sodium, but that is one way to remove the calcium.
Okay, yeah, we do have a water softener, and we do fill it with salt a lot, but, you know, you still get that calcium residue on, like, dishes you wash and stuff like that, and, you know, you can still taste it, plus you get the salt from it. So I was just wondering if you guys knew of another way to kind of clear that out even.
Yeah, I don't. Testing for hardness, and often the water softeners, at least the newer ones, are going to have a setting, an adjustment that you can make that really matches up your hardness level, and you're able to program that into the water softener. So maybe there's something out of sync there. Maybe you certainly have really hard water. We got to know that the water softener is sized and maybe has that capacity to take out what you have.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Judy and Racine, on to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about sump pumps. Is there a reliable backup for a sump pump other than batteries?
Silence there, huh?
Yeah, certainly having a sump system it's good to have more than one pump if you really want a backup, for one thing, because sometimes you can have pump failure.
Right.
But then having one on a system with a battery backup is a good way to deal with that, you know, torrential thunderstorm that knocks out the power and mm-hmm. then knocks us down with, you know, 5 to 10 inches of water. You know, that's when people's sump systems are often overwhelmed. And so even when the power is on. So I don't know of any other real way to back it up.
Have you had problems with a battery system, and have you tried that? Or
yeah, we have a battery system, and you know, it takes a big battery, and you have to replace it periodically. But the other thing, our neighbor has done something, and I don't understand it, but it's some kind of a water system that keeps the pump going if it goes out.
Hmm.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'd have to learn no more idea. About that. But whether it's a battery system, maybe there's a small photovoltaic panel that can keep that battery nice and charged and topped off and keep that useful life of that battery a little bit longer. Certainly if that battery is not being charged or you have to do it manually, I can see where it may not last more than 2 or 3 years.
Right.
So keeping that battery sitting there and topped off is going to really help you get 7 to 10 years out of that if we're talking a lead acid battery. But we do need to keep it not just sitting there idle, because its capacity is going to be diminished day by day. So
right. Now, how did you say you do that? How do you keep it charged?
We can have a solar electric panel designed to charge that battery. Some are solar electric panels can be self-regulating, meaning the voltage level isn't so high where we're going to overcharge that battery, and we keep it just topped off, hooked to we run a wire outside, mount a solar panel in a nice sunny location. There are some steps to take in design, so we can consult a local solar professional to do that. It can be a very really simple system to connect a solar electric panel to that battery and increase that longevity.
Ah, that sounds good. We have a solar-powered fan, and we also have the solar tubes.
Excellent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They are wonderful.
Yeah.
So that would be good. So I have to find a local solar
Yeah, which
contractor.
you should be able to do that in Racine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, is it possible to install an exhaust fan in an interior bathroom? The bathroom has no windows, does not have an exhaust fan, but it does have the only tub shower system with so you get moisture. This is a two-story Cape Cod with a crawl space between the second floor and the roof.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like it's a first floor bathroom, and so you're going to have to run the ductwork for that either through a second floor partition out through the roof, or what is more common is to run it through the ceiling of the first floor and then vent it out often the roof on that edge where there's a knee wall. But, you know, ventilation is only as good as the ductwork that connects the fan blower to the exterior. So you want to make sure that that duct is, has few turns in it, as few as you can design into it. And ideally, it's going to be a rigid duct, or if it is a flexible duct, it should be oversized, so that you get plenty of airflow. Often if we do a flexible, we want it to be 6 inches round. If that duct is going through any places which are not insulated, it's really critical that the duct be insulated. Once it gets outside of the envelope, you insulate it to the roof deck, and that way you don't have the warm, moist air that you're venting condensing once it gets beyond your envelope.
So I think the tricky part was getting the ducting in, correct?
Yeah.
Or with that finished ceiling. So it's just going to take some sheetrock, putting a little bit of holes, finding the joist bay that you want to run in, cutting that certain sections out so you can fish that properly sized ductwork out to the perimeter, right? Yeah. There's just no way around that. Maybe we can have if we're doing a little repair to the bathroom, we can go to the basement if the basement is there. If we maybe... That's pulling some sheetrock or wall paneling off in the bathroom and going down and then out maybe through a rim joist, maybe an alternative. Somewhere we're going to have to cut some holes. So,
Diane in Appleton, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I just wanted to say in regard to the woman who was calling about that sump pump failure, the best thing to have is a rider on your insurance policy to cover sump pump failure, just as a peace of mind. But anyway, my question is this. For the vents that vent your toilet on the top of your roof, when those are covered with snow, because I know they only make them like about 4 inches tall or 6 inches tall, when those are covered with snow, is that going to cause sewer gas to back up in the house? Or does, because I had a house where I would actually have to go out and take a roof rake, you couldn't even see them, and I just wondered if that was a hazard.
Well, you know, there's hot air coming out of that sewer vent, and while it is possible for that to be obstructed, typically wherever we have vents on a home, because there's hot exhaust or something that at least is going to melt snow and prevent ice from building up, it's not something that you likely need to worry about. It's going to take care of itself.
Yeah, I think that warm, moist air is going to work its way through that snow and not be a total obstruction if we don't have ice there. And I've never seen really the sewer odors backing up as a result of it not functioning of snow.
All right. There you have it. Thank you, Diane, for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner, of the Energy Center of Wisconsin, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking home renovation and repair today with Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison and John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Glad to have these guys back. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. We had some questions about water and water quality issues on the program, and someone emailed to remind me that in our show, Dealing with Water, which was yesterday, actually, if you go to Google or a search engine, and I know of Google for sure, if you type in, what's wrong with my water, what's wrong with my water, the first site that pops up is the DNR Water website. And that's probably as good a place to go for testing and other information about water and water quality that you're going to find in the state. So it's, again, it's what's wrong with my water. And thanks for that email reminding me what I probably should have remembered. John in Milwaukee has a question for you guys. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Larry. Hi to Chad and John, too. Thanks for taking my call. My question is the insulation used in the joist areas of the foundation in the basement. Currently, I've got fiberglass insulation there. Last fall, I surrounded the house and I filled up the mouse hole, so to speak, with steel wool, and I sealed it with some spray insulation, you know, the foam insulation. So now there's a couple areas I need to take out this, their nest area, so to speak, and replace it. But is there a more efficient material than just the bat insulation? And also, could I put on a plastic barrier around the that foundation area of the house? To add an extra layer of insulation? Is that still recommended?
So we're talking about right above the foundation wall in what we'll call the rim joist area, that you're sealing up the holes, and maybe you've removed some of the fiberglass so you could spray foam to the interior up against the rim and fill some gaps and seams that you have there, and then you replace the fiberglass bat back in place at this point, right?
I will be doing that. I have not taken it out yet. I didn't know whether that foam insulation is sealing the mice out,
okay,
or whether they're just going to bite their way through that.
Yeah. Spray foam or a rigid foam board is a common practice. Though, if you have that rim nice and tight with the caulking and the spray foam that you've done,
yes,
and you're not sure how good it's going to keep the mice out, it may be beneficial just to use that fiberglass, maybe on a temporary basis, maybe on a full-time basis, so that you can inspect that at a later time and see if there's any necessary follow-up repairs that need to be done. Now,
all right.
Personally, if you have that rim joist nice and airtight and did a good job there, whether you have the fiberglass in there or a rigid foam board or spray foam, the dollar savings, there isn't a lot of energy savings to be had there, so we wouldn't do it because You know, if we have an R19 fiberglass bat stuffed into there, a nice airtight rim joist versus a couple inches of foam that's there, you're not going to see any difference in dollar value savings.
All right.
The most important part is making it airtight. The primary concern, other than the energy use, certainly is related to moisture condensating up against that rim joist, and it can squeak by in and around and through that fiberglass insulation. So if you have a moist basement that gets damp throughout the year, then certainly we'd want to put something a little bit better insulating material in there that's going to prevent moisture movement coming in contact with that rim joist.
Thank you.
And I would just add to that that if, you know, often when a homeowner is applying foam, it's often a one-part foam like Great Stuff or some of the latex foams that are out there. And these foams do not have very good adhesive qualities when, you know, they're good for filling a gap or a hole. But when you've got that huge rim joist space, a lot of times Great Stuff will just fall out of the space, so it's hard to use that. And so professional would apply is a two-part foam, and that's not something that a homeowner can really obtain very easily. Often the best thing a homeowner can do is to cut up a rigid foam board and then caulk it well on the four sides, you know, meticulously cutting up the foam board and caulking it into place. That is generally for a do-it-yourself approach the easiest way to air seal that cavity. And then, as John said, you can put a fiberglass bat back into it.
Mm-hmm. All right. There you have it. Thank you very much for calling, John. Doug in Menasha, on to you. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, hi. One of the previous callers was wondering about the battery backup for the sump pump. And I just wanted to say that a real easy and inexpensive solution for that would be something called a flow charger. You can get it any place where you get a battery charger for a car. And it's got circuitry built into it that detects the level of charge in the battery, and it'll just maintain it, and you can just hook it up and forget it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And this is something that you'd plug into your home
outlet. Yeah, it's just like a regular battery charger, only it does it at a really low level, and it actually senses whatever the charge level of the battery is.
Yeah, so that's perfect.
You'll use more energy.
More energy. It's fun to use that solar, so I don't want to disadvantage that.
Right. No, I mean, and it's true. It obviously does then continuously use electricity, but it's at a pretty low rate.
Yeah.
And they're only $20 to $40. You can get them pretty much anywhere, and you know you don't have to run any new wiring or anything for it.
Yep. Good option.
And then I also wanted to mention another earlier caller about having a hard water situation with a tankless water heater. Obviously, you know, the water softener is of course a good idea, but there's a brand called Rinnai. And they design their tankless water heaters for hard water situations. What it does is they try and balance the water flow so that it's high enough to minimize the buildup, but not so high that it starts to erode the heat exchanger. So, you know, if you got a real hard water situation, you know, in addition to getting a water softener, you know, maybe the Rinnai brand of tankless water heaters is the way to go.
Okay.
Yeah, the only comment I would make to that is that whenever the unit's not being used, it's essentially, it has water sitting in it. And we occasionally have Rinnai, tankless systems installed in our projects. And I still would urge the homeowner to have, pre-softened water going into that appliance.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree with you, too. I'm just saying it's another step in the process of trying to control the problem.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
Yep, thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Good tips there. Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee next. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John and Chad. Thanks for getting me on. I called last fall regarding a new gas furnace we had installed, and I was concerned about higher humidity levels in the air. And you said that the problem would probably rectify itself during the winter, which it did, thank you. But now I'm having another problem with the furnace, and it was installed the beginning of October, and in February, all of a sudden, you'd hear the, I guess it's the inducer motor start going on, and it would just cut out, and the furnace, you know, it was just dead. And so if you turned off the furnace or the thermostat, either or, and then turned it back on again, the furnace would start. And so I had the furnace company over a couple times, and they replaced a few things.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally they informed me that now they think it's a thermostat. And I'm wondering, does this sound feasible to you?
A thermostat, not necessarily the thermostat on the wall, but some temperature sensor.
Well, they are talking about now replacing the thermostat on the wall.
Hmm. Sometimes I've seen this with the inducer fan motor cutting out has to do in the past with placement of the intake and the exhaust of the vent pipe.
Okay.
So that inducer fan motor comes on for 30 to 40 seconds, and what it's testing for is to prove that there is a draft.
Mm-hmm.
So if, let's say we're just simply on a windy location and the exhaust port of that furnace is on the windward side and wind is blowing into that pipe because of gust and gales, then that inducer fan motor cannot prove that there's a draft going in the appropriate direction. And sometimes, so it's, what I've seen, it's been coming back to placement of the intake and the exhaust so that we can actually prove a draft. So I don't know if you're in a windy location.
Well, actually, it's on the west side of the house, and there is another house next door. And it's been cutting off quite a bit today. In fact, the company is coming over again this afternoon mm-hmm. to replace the thermostat, and that's why I'm wondering if this is feasible. But they've checked the intake and outtake valve, and when the days that this has been happening, it's been very calm outside and no wind, you know.
Wow.
So that's why it's so puzzling.
Yeah, and it's puzzling for that technician, too, as these things are intermittent. Sometimes work and sometimes they don't. So if it's on a calm day or if there's an alcove or just a corner of a house that's catching the currents just right, generally that furnace is going to overcome that and not have these types of issues.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it comes back to the thermostat or not, I don't see how that switch on the wall turning the furnace on and off is connected to that inducer.
They said something about, well, when it happens, according, it's all computerized, I
yep.
guess, and it says that it's something to do with the pressure switch. And
yeah.
They replaced the pressure switch with a new furnace. Almost all the parts have been replaced. And so they said something about the thermostat is sending the wrong voltage signal to the furnace.
Okay. Well, we're just going to rely on that technician because it's hard to come up with anything more definitive than what we've discussed without really being there and putting the gauges and the tools to, one, test that voltage and make sure those switches are opening and closing. And I think the technician probably is doing their best in these intermittent episodes. Really just take patience to nail that down.
Yeah. Good luck. Hope this one works. Thanks a lot for calling, Diane. Oh, boy. Chris in Two Rivers. On to you now. Hi, Chris.
Thank you. Matter of fact, I just did replace the thermostat for and the same problem, and that was the case. My question, though, had to be talking about lead. My son was real small when we were remodeling a 100-year-old farmhouse, and he had a lot of fun taking a hammer and smashing off all the plaster off the walls. Is there some health issues that, you know, as an adult now he should be aware of from that exposure?
Well, I'm not an expert on the health impacts of lead, but all I can say is that the sorts of symptoms that we can see from lead exposure has to do with brain development. I mean, that it affects brain development in young children, and so it would have had an impact on cognitive abilities, possibly attention deficit. But again, I really am
not a doctor.
I'm not an expert on this issue.
But yeah, I don't see any of that problem. Is there a phone number that a person can call for information on that?
Let me check on that. We'll come up. Stay listening.
All right.
Chris, and I'll see what I can come up with. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. To Richard in Cudahy next. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My problem is I have a garage floor that's very severely pitted due to salt, et cetera, over the past 25 years. What are my options for repairing that other than having a whole new floor put in?
Well, there are some contractors that specialize in cement refinishing and restoration, and they can fill the, you know, they can do some things to essentially fill in where it is pitted and then recoat the surface in, you know, using a variety of different types of industrial, often solvent-based sealers that, you know, the, not the the greenest materials to work with, but they can do a good job of prolonging the life of that cement surface. And so we work with a couple of contractors in the Madison area. I think if you you know, look in the phone book under you know, cement, I think there's cement resurfacers, but I mean, you should be able to Google that and find some contractors that would specialize in refinishing cement, and of course using trade associations like NARI to search for that, I would recommend as well. But that as far as what something you might be able to buy, do it yourself, that I'm not familiar with.
Okay, because I've talked to a number of cement contractors that have been doing the work around town, and they all look at me like I'm nuts, that there's nothing they can do.
It's not going to be just a general cement contractor that's going to do this work. It's someone that specializes in resurfacing and sealing cement, you know, so that
it's a different person,
right? It's a different specialty, and like I say, if you were to Google, you know, cement refinishing or cement sealing and resurfacing or repair, you might find those individuals.
Okay, I'll try that.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And for the person who called in about more information about lead, I do have a website. The U.S. Department of Labor has, put in the search engine, lead issues health, and up popped, the first thing that popped up was the U.S. Department of Labor, which has significant amount of information relating to lead and how to get more information. So for that earlier caller. And let's see, we have someone else, James, emailed, lost his cell connection before his turn was up here, so I'll get him in here. Springy floors in a loft area. We had a cabin built 3 years ago. We've noticed the floors seem more springy now. The floor is 3/4-inch tongue and groove pine boards nailed directly to a 6x6 pine beams that are spanning a 16-foot distance. And I suspect the beams are not adequate to provide the proper rigidity, but I'm not sure. If they are undersized, what options do I have to increase the rigidity or decrease the springy feeling when we walk up there?
Yeah, well, it would be a good thing to have a structural engineer or just a specialist at the lumberyard to probably help you to determine if the span is adequate. And then if you find it isn't, you probably are going to have a few options. One thing might be to add additional support alongside the existing beams so that they do become adequate. I mean, one question is, are the beams the problem or is it the actual floor surface? Because depending on the spacing of the beams, that's all information you're going to need to know. You know, how frequently do those beams, those 6x6 beams, cross the surface? So there are a variety of things that can be done. Additional beams might be needed. You might, let's say the beams are every 4 feet. You might end up adding one in between each so that they're every 2 feet. Again, someone at a qualified professional would be able to give you some options.
Mm-hmm. What's the maximum CFM that you recommend to replace an existing built-in kitchen exhaust fan with a 6-inch existing vent pipe? Space isn't a problem. Is 250 CFM a lot, or should I go as big as 400 CFM if I can?
Well, I think generally the 250 is going to be adequate, though there are some guidelines depending on whether you have a standard stove and range, gas range, or a little bit larger industrial type stove or range that you have. So generally we find the sellers of a nice industrial or a nice commercial stove top and oven are going to try to bump you up to a little bit larger capacity, though there's cautions when doing so. So I don't want to tell somebody to put in a 4-inch or 400 CFM one only if you have a 6-inch pipe. That's pretty small and you're not going to get that capacity out of there. So that in itself is going to bring you down to the 250 range, and you'll be lucky to get 250 CFM out of that 6-inch pipe. The concern that I mentioned is related to safety of the water heater and possibly the furnace or the boiler, the type of heating system that you have. If they do vent into a masonry chimney and rely on the stack effect of warm air simply meandering up and out of your house, these large exhaust fans have potential to pull the flue gases from these other appliances that seem seemingly unconnected to your kitchen range, but through air movement and pressure changes within the building, there can be a cause and effect. You turn on the fan, and we pull the flue gases from your water heater, your heating system, back into the house. So we don't want necessarily a high-volume kitchen range without really ensuring safety related to your water and heating system.
All right. And someone mentions on a second pump, if a second pump is installed, we're talking about a sump pump, whether AC or battery, make sure that it's on a separate breaker. Often a failing pump will trip its breaker and you won't know what has happened until it's too late.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, I guess on the DC, that's going to be totally, we won't be on a breaker then. It'll just be powered by the battery on the DC system if we have that in place.
Correct. And then regarding the woman asking about a better backup sump pump system, this old house featured a siphon system, and I think that's probably what the caller's neighbor had, that used water pressure to pump out the sump. You would want to be on a city water system, of course, because a well pump will go down when the power is out. So,
interesting.
And for more information on sump pump backup, someone else phoned in. There's a search engine. If you go to any search engine and type in water powered sump, that's another place to go.
Great.
And boy, I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but once again, all the lines are filled. We're out of time, and I've got a lot of emails here. But guys, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, full-service residential remodeling company. You can go online to his website at chadscarpentry.com. That's chadscarpentry.com. John Viner, residential building performance expert at the Energy Center of Wisconsin, and their website is ecw.org, ecw.org. Then they'll be back, and we will do this again with them. Coming up tomorrow, Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson, home horticulture education educator for Extension and for Dane County, will be our guest. Stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.